the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Let's read the Bible together, shall we? Let's read from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And this is on page 1123 of the Green Bible, but you don't need that kind of help, do you? 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and we're going to read from verse 12. Well, the passage tonight comes from two of Paul's letters to the same church, to the church in Thessalonica, and number one ends with some advice, which obviously wasn't followed completely by everybody, because it pops up again in the second letter. So, first of all, 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 12. Now we ask you, brothers and sisters, to acknowledge those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard and love because of their work. Live in peace with each other. And we urge you, brothers and sisters, warn those who are idle and disruptive. Encourage the disheartened. Help the weak. Be patient with everyone. Make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always strive to do what is good for each other and for everyone else. And then in 2 Thessalonians, just turning over one page and going to chapter 3, you read about some problems they were having. And we'll read from verse 6. Chapter 3 and verse 6. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, we command you, brothers and sisters, to keep away from every believer who is idle and disruptive and does not live according to the teaching you received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example. We were not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's food without paying for it. On the contrary, we worked night and day, laboring and toiling so that we would not be a burden to any of you. And we did this not because we do not have the right to such help, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you to imitate. For even when we were with you, we gave you this rule: anyone who is unwilling to work shall not eat. We hear that some among you are idle and disruptive. They're not busy, they're busy bodies. Such people we command and urge in the Lord Jesus Christ to settle down and earn the bread they eat. And as for you, brothers and sisters, never tire of doing what is good. Well, that's all we're going to read. And we're going to use those verses as the backdrop to the next one in the series, of which we have now reached the third last installment. We've called it Flashpoints, and it's about the quarrels that people had in the days of the early church. Because the same reason for flashpoints, for arguments, still persist in the church today. And we need to look at these things carefully, because it's possible we could end up in the same situation, as many people have done down through history. So far, we've spoken about disagreeing over details. We've spoken about promoting personalities. We've spoken about relying on rules. Last of all, we were talking about emphasizing experiences, and tonight we're talking about coasting in comfort, which is what some of those idle and disruptive people in Thessalonians were obviously doing. We've still got to come after that preaching for profit and wanting the world, but tonight it's coasting in comfort. Why was that? Why were the Christians not doing any work? Why were they being idle? Well, it's because they had a very strong view that the Lord Jesus Christ was coming back very soon. They were a bit like this guy. This is William Miller, who became famous in the early 1840s, because round about 1830, he had worked out when Jesus Christ was coming back. It was a complicated system he'd worked out, based on the book of Daniel and all kinds of charts like this one, which he wrote, and he became convinced that Jesus must come back in the year 1843. Well, at first nobody paid much attention to him, but Miller was a farmer who did a lot of lay preaching, and he wrote a few pamphlets about his ideas, and then started very timidly mentioning them when he went round to preach. And soon the movement caught fire, and before very long, people were becoming what they called Millerites, and there's one of the original Millerite churches. He never intended to start a denomination, but people who believed Jesus is coming back in 1843 started to get together in places like that. And the leaflets went all over the place as well. The end of the world in 1843. Well, 1843 came, and he thought there were three possible dates. Jesus didn't come on any of them. And then somebody pointed out to him that he'd forgotten the time switch from BC to AD. That added on another year. And so he realized it was actually going to be 1844. So everybody started again. And now they were being pilloried by people all over America. The grand ascension of the Miller Tabernacle. And when the night came, when Jesus was supposed to return, I think it was October the 22nd, 1844, some people dressed in white and stood on the roofs of their houses, and here's a cartoon satirizing them, the Millerites waiting for the world to come to an end. And they just simply, I don't know why they were on the roof, I suppose it got them slightly nearer heaven by a few feet and sped up Jesus' journey a little bit, but one way or another, they waited there all through the night, and Jesus still didn't come back. It's what's now known as the Great Disappointment. And the sad thing was that many of them had given up good jobs. They'd sold their property. They were so convinced this was the end of all things coming on them that after October the 23rd, they had not a clue what they were going to do with the rest of their lives and no idea how they were going to survive to do it. And it's a sad story. It goes back, I suppose, to the importance of that verse in the Bible, which Miller seems to have neglected, which says nobody knows the times and the seasons that the Father has in his own hand. You're not supposed to know when Jesus is coming back. The Bible doesn't give you a ready reckoner guide on the subject. But it also makes the point that if you become obsessed with the fact that it's all going to come to an end anyway, I don't have to do anything. There's no point in having a career. No point in doing anything, because Jesus is coming back any minute. Then you can become a bit of an oddball in the circles in which you move, and somebody who potentially is going to be a bit of a burden on other Christians too. There aren't many people who think like that nowadays. The Jehovah's Witnesses would be a case in point. They believe that the Battle of Armageddon is going to happen so soon that they used to advise their young people not to go to university, not to start on lucrative careers, but to go into the pioneers instead, because getting the message out was all important. Who knows? At any moment, the battle might break out, then the end of the world will take place. I notice over the last few years, they've relented, and they now have people going to university, because obviously they've decided it is worthwhile. I don't know what their thinking is. But when you're convinced that the end is coming, then it's easy just to run out of steam and stop doing anything. Now, maybe we wouldn't be like that nowadays. We have got the message firmly that when Jesus is coming back, he will come back, and there's no point in trying to second-guess the process. And as Christians have held down through the centuries, what we're called to do is just to keep on being faithful and carrying on right to the end. Martin Luther had a brilliant answer for somebody who once asked him, "What would you do if you knew for sure that Jesus Christ was coming back tomorrow?" Luther thought for a second and said, "I would plant a tree," which is great. He'd never see that tree grow, but he'd be doing exactly what he was supposed to do, ignoring everything and just keeping on being faithful, living life, and being faithful to Jesus till he came back. And so we've maybe got that, but it's still possible for us to get into a First Thessalonian situation nowadays. It may have been that it was because they thought Jesus was coming back, they were doing very little. But there can be reasons in our day, can't there? And there can be ways in which the church can be weakened by the fact that some people are just not pulling their weight. This is Joseph Duran, who invented what's called the Pareto Principle earlier on in the 20th century. It was based on the work of Vilfredo Pareto, an Italian economist, who'd noticed way back in the year 1900 that 20% of the people who lived in Italy actually owned 80% of the goods, the big houses, the land. And Duran, thinking about this, said the Pareto principle is that 20% of the constituents of a group will be responsible for 80% of the effects. In other words, if you've got a shop and you've got 10 different items on the shelves, two of them will probably be responsible for 80% of your income. The other eight won't sell out quite so quickly. If you've got a staff of 10 people, probably two of them will be producing 80% of the effective work, and the others are just loafing along in the background. The Pareto principle, he said, is that you have the vital few and the trivial many. And he said, that's just a law of human affairs. It's just the way it always tends to work. But that should not be the case in the church. The church shouldn't be like that. We are all on a level. We've all been given gifts by God. Whether you have a big contribution to make or a small contribution, it's still important, it's still vital. And it should not be that a few people do everything and everybody else coasts along in comfort. Maybe our reason today isn't the second coming of Jesus. Maybe it's, well, life is so busy, I have such a demanding career, I can't really get as involved as I'd like to. Or, well, I used to work hard for the Lord earlier in my life, but you know, I've lived a long life, I've fulfilled a tremendous ministry, it's time now to settle back a little bit and let the younger people take over. How old are you? 23. You know. And we can make excuses for ourselves on all sorts of fronts, can't we? And this, don't worry, this sermon is not a plea for us all to become frenetic activists. But we do need to be thinking seriously. Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Or am I coasting along in comfort and letting other people do the stuff that I ought to be doing? See, Thessalonica was a very comfortable place to be because of this road. This is the Ignatian Way, one of the great trade routes that runs right through from Albania in the west, right through to Istanbul in the east. That was the line of it. And as you can see, if you look at the left-hand side of the map, once you'd come from Istanbul all the way to Durres in Albania, there was a shipping route straight across to Italy, and from the place you landed, Brindisi in Italy, there was a road called the Via Appia that took you straight up to Rome. So motorway, door to door. And if you can see, you have to have sharp eyes to see it, but if you can see Thessalonica on there, you'll see it stands right in the middle of Ignatian Way. It's also a seaport, a very big and powerful seaport, always has been. And so it was a centre for trade and industry. 40,000 people lived there in Paul's day. And it was a place of luxury. It was a place where some people were pretty wealthy. Paul went on from Thessalonica down to Corinth. And the people who became Christians in Corinth and formed the church down there were poor. Some of them were slaves. None of them were thought of much by the world. And Paul writes to them on that basis later on, as you might remember. Thessalonica, it was a bit different. It was all the people with money and social standing who became Christians in Thessalonica. You find that out from Acts 17 and also from the way that Paul speaks to them later on. They weren't Jews either. Most of them were Gentiles. Paul talks in 1 Thessalonians 1 about how they turned from idols to serve the living God. So although there were Jews and God-fearers involved, most of them had come right out of paganism. And they ranked high in the community where they were. They had comfortable lives. Many of them were quite comfortable because of the Roman system of patronage. This is actually from a website about Pompeii, but the same system applied in Thessalonica, so it makes the point. When you got up in the morning, if you were somebody's client and they were your patron, it says this, once you were dressed and ready for work, you had one duty to perform that has no real modern equivalent. This was the morning ritual called the salutatio. You had to pay your respects to your patron. Or if you were a patron, you stepped outside to receive respects and give out a dole to your clients gathered about your door. Virtually everyone in Pompeii and quite a few in Thessalonica was a client or a patron to someone, and many were both. So the way it worked was, if you were a wealthy landowner and they were all over the place in Thessalonica, you would have a bunch of people who were your clients. And it might be because they were members of your family, second cousins, long lost, twice removed, whatever. Or it might be because they were freed slaves who were still counted as members of your family and would be buried in your tomb after they died. And every morning when you got up and had your breakfast, you would see a queue forming outside your front gate. And the first task of the day would be to go down and speak to them all, one by one. They'd be lined up in order of rank as to how close they were to you. And to every single one, you would be expected to give some little gift, some food, some money, some advice about a lawsuit or whatever, and if they had any problems, they would have to bring them to you, and you could spend the first hour of the day just talking to those people and looking after them. Now, if you were a client of a wealthy man, you had to go to the salutatio, and he could then say, I need you today, hang around, stick around, I've got a job for you. Most of the time, however, he would say, okay, here's your breakfast, off you go. And the rest of the day would be free. It was a brilliant system. It meant that most of the time you got looked after for doing absolutely nothing. And so if you got yourself on the inside of a system like that, you could hang around and be as idle as you wanted. And it wasn't fair, because there were people in the church struggling to keep the whole thing together, working amongst other Christians, making the whole thing move. And these people had all the time in the world to go around and just make mischief. So that was a problem. Now, in this Flashpoint series, we've had a look at three things each night. So let's look at those three. First of all, the cause. Where does this flashpoint come from? I think as you read these verses and understand the background, there are four main causes of the flashpoint caused by some Christians coasting along in comfort while others are working their fingers to the bone. The first thing, obviously, is that people can make excuses for themselves. We've talked a bit about that. But it's always easy to, when something challenging or demanding comes along in the church, to start thinking instinctively, straight away, help, help, what's my excuse? How do I get out of this one? And some people are just very, very good at doing that without even realizing they're doing it. It was certainly happening in Thessalonica. And idle and disruptive people are mentioned in both 1 Thessalonians 5, 2 Thessalonians 3. It was a curse of that relatively well-heeled city. The second thing is that some people refuse to settle down. They won't commit to anything. And that's a problem you still see nowadays, isn't it? People who don't invest their time and their effort in any one particular aspect of God's work, but church hop. Go around from one place to another. Now, one of the blessings and the curses of living in Exeter over the last 50, 60 years has been that the evangelical churches have had such a good relationship with one another. It's a blessing. It's great to see such unity, and it's a curse, because it's easy for people to move on from Pinhoe Road to St. Leonard's to Frontiers to Vineyard to Belmont to somewhere else, and you keep moving round. And as soon as people start thinking, well, he's been around a while, it's time we gave him a job. Oh, the Lord's called me somewhere else. And off you go. Too easy to do that, isn't it? And to really get stuck in with one group of believers, to take the rough as well as the smooth, and to stay there for keeps, to treat it as seriously as your marriage vows, for richer, for poorer, for better or for worse, to see where God has put you in the church as something desperately important and strategic that you will not walk away from unless he specifically calls you to go somewhere else. That is a kind of thinking that often doesn't happen. And so that's why Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 3, we urge these people to settle down and earn the bread they eat. Some refuse to settle down. Third, leaders sometimes observe this going on and do nothing. I mean, how do you say to somebody, you are terminally bone idle? You have one spiritual problem, and it's laziness. You don't do that in our culture, do you? And it is a problem that concerns me. I can think of one lady at the moment, whom I know, who has years of useful life left to her, who is doing nothing with her time at all. She's in church fellowship, but she's a taker, not a giver. And she's constantly unhappy, constantly complaining, constantly asking for more, because she will not invest anything too much in anybody else. I can see you all looking at me and trying to identify her. I'm not going to give any more away than that. But, you know, she worries me, because I'm thinking I should be saying something to her. She could live for another 20 years and just waste them entirely. She won't enjoy them. Other people will find it a real pain. And somebody needs to sit down with her and say, the problem with you is you need to do some serious work. We don't find that easy, do we? And yet Paul says this is a responsibility of leaders. We've got to get people moving. I remember Derek once making the comment to me that he thought the Lord was giving him a ministry of sanctified grumpiness, because he found himself having arguments with so many people on subjects like that. And I think that's a great ministry to have, except when he applies it to me, of course. But it's tremendous, isn't it? When you've got people who will really confront others lovingly in the name of Jesus, and all too often that doesn't happen. And Paul says that needs to happen. Leaders who observe but do nothing are part of the problem. And then the fourth bit of the problem is this, that good-natured Christians are exploited. If somebody's not going to work, says Paul, if he's unwilling to work, let him not eat. That's a simple answer. Because as Christians, we tend to say, oh, I must share with you, my brother. I must look after you, my sister. And people can manipulate that. They can exploit that. And that's one of the reasons for the shameful advertising commercial culture that we have in the evangelical church, with everybody jockeying for money and trying to get hold of people's support. Why is there such an advertising industry in Christian magazines? It's because people know Christians will give if you just approach them in the right way. And I'm not saying that ministries and missions and groups like that don't need to make their needs known. Of course they do. But it's easy to take it to extremes, isn't it? And just rely on God's people and their good nature to help you coast through life. So if that's the cause, and that was why people were hanging around in the marketplace instead of putting in a day's work, and that's the marketplace in Salonika, or going to the games all the time, and that's the auditorium in Salonika, what do you do about it? Well, let's look first at the risk. Is it really a problem? What dangers does it produce? Well, here are four things that I think happen. First of all, the lazy become disruptive. Did you notice in those two chapters, three times you read idle and disruptive? The phrase goes together. When you're doing nothing, when you're sitting on your bottom simply watching it spread out around you as you get fatter and fatter, all that happens is you start to disrupt the lives of other people. Because you're not doing anything useful, you get them annoyed and you disrupt other people. You get so bored, you start making mischief where you shouldn't be making mischief. That's why Paul says they're not busy, they're busy bodies. They've got nothing going on in their own lives, so they start to spoil everybody else's. It shouldn't be that way. The lazy become disruptive. The devil finds work for idle hands to do. Second, the workers become disheartened. That, I think, is why Paul says at the end of 1 Thessalonians 5, encourage those who are becoming disheartened. Because when you see other people coasting through life and you're not, you know, why am I doing this? I must be a sucker. Why am I here at this time in the morning, at this time in the evening, and everybody else is at home watching Andy Murray or something like that? What's going on here? Why am I working so hard and nobody else is? And we can all start to feel like that. And we start to lose our courage because we start to think we're being taken for a ride. And it's okay saying, well, I'm doing this for Jesus. I'm doing this for the Lord. But ultimately think, well, they're supposed to be committed Christians as well. Why aren't they doing what I'm doing? So the workers become disheartened. The idle become busybodies. They start interfering in affairs that are none of their business. And one of the reasons that you have disputes and quarrels very often in churches is because people have time on their hands that ought to be invested in the Lord's work. And instead of using that energy productively, they use it to start a fight with somebody else. It might be about something they've said or done. It might be about a point of doctrine. It doesn't matter. They just go barging in and start a quarrel. And then the whole thing ends in the fourth result, which is that the church becomes ineffective. Poor little quarrelsome Christianity is the way we were described by an atheist poet in the 19th century. Down through the centuries, Christians have had a reputation for squabbling, for fighting, for splitting off from one another. It ought not to be that way. And where you see a fellowship where people are pulling their weight, where everybody is working to one another's strengths and gifts and abilities, where there is a sense of an orchestra producing a piece of music together, then you've got something wonderful and beautiful, and the kind of stuff that Carol's been reporting people sometimes see, not always, but sometimes, when they come into our midst here. And that'd be great, wouldn't it? If we could just make that multiplied more and more in our midst, so that people can see the life of Christ before we've even given them a word about the gospel. So, one more thing to talk about. Let's have a look at six things once again we can do about it. Because I think there are six things, once again, that you can pick out of these two passages. What's the answer? Okay, number one is very simple. Acknowledge those who work hard. Make sure people are appreciated. That's why Paul says, there are those who stand in front of you. The word he uses is proistemi, those who go in front. Because this is so early in church history. This is the very earliest letter, possibly, that Paul wrote to a church. And terms like elders and deacons and overseers and bishops hadn't yet been thought of, really, in Christian terms. And it's all very new. Nonetheless, Paul knows there are people who stand in front, people who work hard in the church. And Paul says, respect them for what they do. They're working in all sorts of ways. They work hard among you, that's physical activity. They care for you in the Lord, that's emotional activity. And they admonish you, that's mental activity. Standing in front of you saying, you're not doing it right, you need to do this and not that. And all of those levels, they're working hard. So, says Paul, hold them in the highest regard in love because of their work. Notice he says, because of their work, not because of their work rate. It's not just that it's hard work, although Christian workers ought to work hard, but it's the quality of the work. It's what they're doing. It's the fact that they're interacting with your life on all of these different levels. Their work is so important to your survival as a Christian. So honor them. Respect them. Don't look over the fence and say, you know, the leaders in the church next door are a lot better than the leaders in my church. Don't like the leaders in my church very much. Sometimes disagree with them and a funny bunch and they don't make the decisions I would make. Honor them. Respect them. Even when sometimes you disagree with them. My friend Mark Ashton, who was one of the most effective church leaders in Britain until he died tragically young, used to have a little saying which went like this: loyalty begins at the point of disagreement. In other words, you're not being loyal to your church leaders when they're doing what you would do anyway, but when they do something you think, oh, I'm not so sure about that one, that is when your loyalty is tested. So loyalty actually begins at the point of disagreement. when they say we're going this way and you'd rather go that way, do you grouse and grumble about it, or do you say, okay, you might be wrong, but I'm committed to you, I honour you in love because of your work, I trust your judgment, I'm going with you. Loyalty begins at the point of disagreement. So acknowledge those who work hard. Second thing is, do not associate with the idle. Paul is so bothered about this problem, he says, keep away from them. We command you in the Lord, have nothing to do with those people. Make a clear distinction between those who are just troublemakers and a waste of space and those who are really going for it with Jesus. Because otherwise what happens? The ones who are doing nothing drag everybody else's standard down. How do they manage to do that? Well, it's because we know we shouldn't do it, but we all do it. We look at other people and say, well, how am I doing compared to so-and-so? How am I doing compared to so-and-so? And so if the level of Christianity, discipleship, keenness, and eagerness in our church is going down and down and down because people are being idle, you start thinking, well, at least I'm not as bad as him. I'm not as bad as her. I'm not as bad as them. And your standard goes down to match. It just happens, doesn't it? And so we need to be careful that we keep the standard high, that we keep the flame burning brightly and don't associate with people who are going to bring that sort of corrosion into our midst. The third thing is, we've got to warn them. We can't just treat them like a bad smell. We owe it to them to tell them why. And we warn them, but without hostility. Paul says, do this as a brother, not as their enemy. Don't go and say, you lazy, idle, shiftless waste of space, out of the church door and never darken it again. It's not that kind of conversation you're going to have. You're trying to do this for their good. You're trying to get them moving. You're going to try to bring out of their life all the things that Jesus has put there and that God wants to see in action. So warn them and do it in the right way. And the fourth thing is simply this. Follow the apostolic model. Do what the apostles did. Paul said, you know, when we came to you in Thessalonica, we could have expected you to look after us. We have the right for that. This is something that Paul is very keen about. He comes to that point several times in his letters when he says, but we didn't do that. We were independent. We stood on our own feet. We worked for ourselves. I made tents. I made sails. That's my job. So I did that. I raised the money. You didn't have to support me. Why did I do that? Because I wanted to be a model to you. I wanted to show how we can give freely to one another without expecting a tit for tat, a quid pro quo. I didn't want anything back from you. I just wanted to give and give and give, to instill in you a culture of giving and giving and giving. So take me as your model. Take the rest of the apostles as your model. What you see in the best examples of Christianity, copy. And then you won't go far wrong. So that's piece of advice number four. Two more to go and we're done. The fifth one is simply this. Tirelessly keep doing good. Don't get tired. Keep on going, whatever happens. And Paul says this, doesn't he, at the end of his advice chapter 3 of 2 Thessalonians. And as for you, brothers and sisters, never tire of doing what is good. Because it is possible, isn't it, to become weary in well-doing. Tired of doing what's good. I've been bashing away for years, and all I get are kicks and complaints. I've been trying so hard, and nobody appreciates what I'm doing. And I hear all of these suspicions about what I'm supposed to be doing, and everybody can see, just on the face of it, that there's no hidden agenda. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do, and what do I get back for it? Not a thing. I'm getting fed up with this whole thing. We'll all feel like that from time to time, but Paul says, never tire, never grow weary. Don't give up. Don't take a holiday. Just keep on going. Leave your reputation. Leave your reward. Leave the applause to God. He'll make sure you get what's coming to you when it's the right time. But for you, just keep on going and don't get tired. And the final piece of advice we've got on this one is this. Live in peace with one another. And Paul says that again and again throughout these two chapters. Live in peace. Keep the peace going. Because when there are tensions, when there are difficulties between us, that is when the idle flourish. Because when we're not talking to one another in the way that we should, when there isn't the intimacy of relationship there's supposed to be in a church, then people can do things in the cracks and they can pretend they're doing a lot more than they are doing, just flitting from group to group. But when we're working together, shoulder to shoulder, when we're committed to one another as members of the same family, then those who are not really pulling their weight, those who don't really belong, they're going to show up pretty quickly. And so Paul says, keep the peace going. Don't let tensions grow up. Don't waste your energy on futile arguments and quarrels and feuds. And so much of the energy of the Church of Christ down through the centuries has been frittered away in things like that, hasn't it? Keep it focused on the goal. Keep on moving towards the purpose. Don't allow anything to get in the way of a peaceful, harmonious group that works hard to do what the Lord's will is. And I guess in making all of these comments, I think, and you must look back on the things we've been hearing tonight about where we're going as a church and what we've been up to. We just need more of it, don't we? We need to keep that spirit. We need all of us in there together. We need to multiply what's going well already and see more people saved, more Christians grow, more ministries produce more fruit and be massively effective. And we'll do that if we all just work together.